Welcome to episode 222 of the Various Sundry Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Harmon, joined live from the Vault Studio, the beautiful campus of Grace College and Theological Seminary, by my good friend, my colleague, my co-host, and the man who is in position to win the bracket competition, John Scott Sloat.
I don't know if I'm in position to win. I'm within striking distance and could win.
Yeah, well, we'll circle back to that in a minute. But how was your Easter weekend?
Was good. Spent a lot of time at home. Went to Mama and Papa Sloat's house on Sunday afternoon.
How are Scott and Celeste?
Doing well. Doing well. Trying to think if there's any major updates for the pod on them. We had prime rib.
All right. Smoked?
Smoked, of course. Yes. Love prime rib.
Okay. I do too.
Brussels sprouts, some salad, potatoes. It's a good meal.
Is your dad as invested in the smoking as you are?
Financially, probably.
Well, I wasn't really talking financially. I'm talking like just in terms of time and interest and energy.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I'd say so.
Okay.
I think I am willing to try new things on the smoker that he is – like I'd bake cookies on my smoker. I don't think he'd bake cookies.
Yes.
I would do just about anything on my smoker.
Yes. That is very true of you. I know this to be true. So, yes.
I did barbecue salmon last week on my smoker. I homemade a barbecue sauce for salmon.
All right.
It's very good.
Yeah.
Very delicious.
There you go. Well, if you'd like to get in touch with the show and get John's secret barbecue recipe, which I don't know if he'll be willing to offer that or not, but you can try. You can find us on Twitter at VNSPod. You can email the show, variationsundrypodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook and on YouTube, and we would love for you to leave a 5-star rating and a review.
Nice.
All right. John, let's talk some sports.
Let's do it.
The obviously, the big story is the NCAA tournament. Our Final Four is set.
Yes.
Purdue will play North Carolina State.
Wild. Two ACC teams making it.
And UConn will play Alabama. So, yeah. No, just one ACC team.
Is NC State not an ACC team? I thought ACC...
NC State is the ACC team.
Well, who am I thinking? Never mind. Let's just move
Purdue's
on.
In the Big Ten. UConn's in the Big East. And
you're right.
Alabama's in the SEC.
You're right. You're right.
So...
I don't know why I said two.
Well, because... was it...
I guess...
Clemson played Alabama. Was it Clemson played Alabama?
Well, and so did Duke.
Well...
Duke played NC State.
Duke played NC State. Yeah, so... Two teams from the same conference playing for one spot in the I'm really happy for Purdue.
They played a great game against Tennessee.
They were the butt of everybody's jokes the last couple of years, especially last year.
Oh my goodness!
Losing to a 16 as a one. I mean,
If they win the whole thing. The only other team to lose to a 16 was Virginia.
Yes,
who then came to win. Came back to win it next year.
The following year, yeah. So that's the recipe. Get to be a one seed, lose to a 16, then come back the next year, you're going
to
win it.
I'm willing to call it a recipe. I'm not willing to call it the recipe.
Yeah. Yeah. Part of what was impressive about that Purdue-Tennessee game is the fact that the best player for each team played exceptionally well.
I mean,
Edie ended up with 40 points. And what was like 15 or 16 rebounds, something like that. And maybe more impressive was the fact that he played 39 and a half minutes.
Yeah.
For a dude who's 7'4 and 300 pounds to play 39 and a half minutes of a college basketball game is impressive. Now, I will say there's an enormous amount of timeouts and media timeouts, but still.
And he's got a week off.
Yes. Yes. So, but still, that's still impressive. And the Dalton Connect for Tennessee.
He was great.
played super well. He just did. He had no help. Yeah. No help whatsoever.
Yep.
And Edie had just enough help from everybody else, like just enough.
Yeah.
To get by. So that was I think the most entertaining Elite Eight game.
Yeah.
Arguably the least entertaining was UConn Illinois. Well, did you watch this game?
No, I followed the score because at some point UConn just went way ahead.
Yes.
And just didn't let up.
Yeah, they were tied at 23. And then UConn went on a, this is no mistake, a 30-0 run.
Hard to come back from that.
Like basically the last like minute and a half of the first half. And then like the first 7.5 minutes of the second half, 30-0. I don't know how that's possible in an Elite Eight game. Like I get it if the teams are just like wildly mismatched. But somewhere in there you think someone's going to throw it in the bucket.
Well, and I mean UConn has just waltzed its way to the Final Four without much difficulty. I mean they won their opening game 91-52. They beat Northwestern 75-58. They beat San Diego State 82-52. Mm-hmm. And they beat Illinois 77-52.
Yeah, they've been dominant.
They've been really, really good.
And I really don't think Alabama matches up that well with them. The only thing Alabama could offer is they like to shoot a lot of threes. Mm. And so if they just get hot, I think they could potentially hang around and steal one. Other than that, I don't see them challenging. I think Purdue can beat them because they can match them both inside with size and on the perimeter with their guards.
Yeah.
So I think Purdue's got the best chance of beating them. But, I mean, I think the clear favorite out of the Final Four is UConn still.
Absolutely. NC State, what do you think?
It's one of the most surprising runs that I think we've ever seen. I mean, it really is reminiscent of 1983 when they won the national title. They had to win their conference tournament to get in, and they did.
Hmm.
And then they just got hot at the right time. Part of what's just so striking is so they won 5 games in the ACC tournament to get in.
Mm-hmm.
They were not going to get an at-large. So they had to win the conference tournament to get in.
Yeah.
And now they've won 4 games in the NCAA tournament. So they've won 9 straight, basically do-or-die games.
How do you think – because they have a big guy.
Yeah, DJ Burns, I think.
Yeah, and he is how would you describe him? He's thick.
He is. What's he like? Six nine? Is he 6'9"?
6'8", 6'9", I think. Yeah,
and probably what 325?
Yeah. He's definitely more than 300.
Yeah, thick.
How do you think he matches up with Edie?
Well, I mean, Edie's going to have what 5 or 6 inches on him?
More than that. Yeah.
But girth-wise, he'll be able to move Edie around, I think. A lot depends on how they officiate things.
Yeah.
But it will be an interesting contrast. I don't know. I think it's hard to pick against NC State just because of the run they're on.
Yeah.
But
do you trust Purdue yet?
No.
Me either. I kept waiting for them to drop that Tennessee game. Like, yeah. It'll happen here soon.
Yeah. And part of what clued me into maybe it wouldn't happen against Tennessee is Purdue led the entire second half basically. And every time Tennessee had a shot to take the lead, they tied it a couple times.
They did.
But they had multiple shots to go ahead and they missed every one of them. Mm-hmm. Even when they were good looks from like Connect or, you know, other good players. Like, and it's like, okay, when you start to see that trend happening where every time they get a chance to take the lead, they miss the shot, you're like, this just has the vibe of Purdue's going to hang on.
And it felt like they kept getting elbow jumpers and they kept missing elbow jumpers mm-hmm. that they open mostly that they should be knocking down.
Yeah. Tennessee's really good. That's a really impressive win for mm-hmm. for Purdue. But yeah, we'll see. I'm impressed with I'm impressed with Purdue and what they've done to get to the Final Four. I think that's been enough to kind of validate this group.
Yeah.
You know, once you get to the Final Four, I think that kind of validates you.
Yeah. The win over Gonzaga was big.
Yeah.
And then the win over Tennessee, obviously.
Interesting fact, Ohio State actually beat two of the Final Four teams this year.
They beat Purdue once.
Uh-huh.
And they beat Alabama?
They beat Alabama early in the season.
Okay.
Yeah, on a neutral floor. So I'm not saying Ohio State's better than both of those teams. I'm just noting that they beat two of the four Final Four teams. So, yeah, that'll be an interesting matchup next weekend here. I think we need to talk about the bracket.
Oh, yeah.
And how people are doing.
Yeah. Do you know where you're – while I pull it up, do you know where you're located?
I do know exactly where I'm located. I think I deserve some applause for my accomplishment here. You see, I have clinched – last place in the bracket.
Yeah. Ooh. Do you have any Final Four teams left?
No. What was the death blow was what was that, Friday night? It was Friday night because I had two Final Four teams left. I had Houston.
Yeah.
And I had Creighton. And they both lost within like 5 minutes of each other. It's like, great. But I'm a little bitter about Houston. Because they lost a close one to Duke and they lost their best player halfway through the first half. So I'm a little bitter about that one. Creighton felt like more of a risk.
Okay.
But Houston, I'm like, I don't know. I think, yeah. I mean, they were a number one seed for a reason. So
second to last, we should note we have two people that did not fill out brackets.
Yes, somehow. They signed up and then did not complete brackets.
And then we had one guy who were sort of like writing off. I don't quite know who this is, but put Longwood State or Longwood Beach in as their champion, which I believe they were a 15
did
or
they
16 seed.
Did they complete the bracket though? Can you tell?
They got 10 points from the first round and that is it.
Okay. So I guess technically maybe I'm not in last place if that person completed a bracket. So.
But if we're calling you last place – second to last is my sister-in-law's husband.
Okay.
Samuel in Durham.
Okay.
Who went to UNC.
Mm.
And you can imagine picked UNC.
Yeah.
To win it all.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to blame my analytics.
You did a deep dive on analytics.
Not deep, but I looked at some I spent some time looking at some of the analytics in terms of people who do analyze the analytics and saying, hey, these are the teams that, you know, it's one of these things where the last 20 champion out of the last 20 years, 19 of the champions have ranked in the top 10 of this category and the top 20 of this category, you know, like that sort of thing.
That did not work out.
It did not work out for me. So, next year I think I'm literally going all chalk. I think I will just literally go all chalk.
All top seeds?
All of them.
Okay.
And then I'll get to the Final Four and flip coins.
Okay.
I mean, that certainly will prevent me from finishing last.
Absolutely. Should we go through our top five?
Yeah, let's do it.
So I believe last week we had Aaron in Warsaw, pastor here in Warsaw, as number one. He is still number one.
Yes, but his champion is gone.
His tribute has exited the arena.
Yes.
He had chosen Houston to win it all, but he has lost. In second place is a member of my small group who attended NC State.
I don't know who that is.
Ash. Have you met Ash?
I don't know that I have.
Okay. So Ash graduated from NC State.
Okay.
Was a meteorologist in Iowa for a number of years and is now living here.
Okay.
But – he has North Carolina State, NC State in the Final Four, but has Connecticut as his champion.
Okay.
So he's in second. He's got a good shot here.
Yes.
Then there's Joel from Ohio.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of Joel.
Yeah.
He's got Connecticut. And then my father-in-law.
Oh, really?
Is in fourth.
David, right?
David, yes. He's got Connecticut. And okay. I'm in fifth, and I also have Connecticut.
Okay. So you're not really in position to win, I guess. You're at, like—
The best I can finish is fourth.
Okay.
I think.
Okay. Because people with more points than you have UConn as well, right?
Yes. Yes,
but,
yes, yes.
But I guess have you looked to see, like, do they have— who was your championship game?
My championship game was— So I have no Final Four teams other than UConn.
Oh, okay. So you can't get—
Right. I had UConn, Tennessee okay. in the championship.
Okay. Gotcha. Yes. You know who is— – who else picked NC State to go to the Final Four?
Who's that?
My oldest son.
Did he really?
Yeah.
What possessed him?
Well, I mean, look.
Wild.
I'm just going to give him his props and not give him any trash.
Is he?
I'm just going to give him his props and say well done.
Is he on here?
Yeah.
What's his? I see JON, but that's pretty far down the list.
Yeah, he's not in any danger of winning.
That's not him. That person doesn't have NC State.
Is he?
Oh, Jonathan, there it is. Sixth. Yeah, he had NC State versus Duke and Connecticut against Iowa State.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, he got two of the Final Four teams. He had UConn and NC State.
That's better than I did.
So, I had – so he can still get some more points in terms of getting UConn to advance to the final game.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yes, I will simply –
Tip your hat.
Give him his props. Yes. Speaking of tipping the hat, we should also mention that the Grace men's basketball team had a great season. They lost in the Fab Four.
Oh, gosh.
I'm a little salty about that loss. I'm sure the guys are as well.
Yes. I talked to a parent that was very salty about it.
A parent of one of the players?
Okay. A parent of one of the players. Okay. Very salty.
Yeah, well. Yeah, to be honest, I'm stunned. There were ways that I could envision Grace losing. You know, like they lost against Huntington. Their one regular season
sure.
loss. Where Huntington hit like 14 threes and Grace hit one.
Mm-hmm.
I really thought – that's how we'll lose. If we lose somehow in the NAIA tournament, it'll be because the other team just goes off from three and we're stone cold and can't make up the difference. It's not how we lost.
Yeah.
We actually shot it well from three in that game. Mm-hmm. I think we made 14 or 15 threes in that game.
Yeah.
The other team, though, I think they ended up making like 9 or 10. So it was, you know.
And some deep ones.
And,
oh, my goodness.
I mean some 30-foot bombs. And timely ones as well. The biggest disappointment was the fact that I'm going to do two things here. I'm going to give props to the team that beat us, and then I'm going to trash the refs for a moment.
Okay.
So Freed Hardeman is the team that beat us.
That went on to win.
They did, thankfully. And so they went on to win. They double and triple teamed Elijah. Every time he touched the ball in the post. And even when he was posting up, they always had a guy lurking. So it made it really, really difficult to get the ball inside.
Sure.
And despite that, I think – my guess is he probably caught the ball in the paint, in the post, probably what, 20 times in the game? 20 to 25 times in the game?
Yeah.
And despite the fact that every time he caught the ball, he was double and triple teamed with guys digging at the ball around him, not once – did they foul him? Not once. That's really hard for me to believe. Just the law of averages tells you that when two or three guys are around your big man in the post and they're poking and they're, you know, trying to strip the ball away, at least a few times they're going to rake him across the arm. That's just really hard for me to believe. At the same time, it was the best defensive strategy anyone's come up with against Grace. They executed it well, and they won.
Yeah.
So, but disappointing in that, in the sense of even their coach said Grace was the better team. We just executed better tonight.
Hmm.
Which almost feels worse, right?
Yeah.
like he's clearly meaning it as a compliment, but he's basically saying, yeah, we beat a better team than us.
Yeah.
Because we executed.
Don't like that.
No. All right. Anything else on sports? We probably should move on here.
Baseball season's underway. The Mets are off to an 0-3 start to the season.
Okay.
Bench is clearing brawl. Our new manager has already been suspended and served a game suspension. We had a player throw behind a batter and ejected for 3 games, I think. He got a 3-game suspension.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think that pretty much covers it.
Still early, John. Still early.
Well, you want to know what? There's still 159 games to go.
Because it's baseball. That's an eternity. There's too many games in baseball, right?
I don't think so.
Really?
I like the marathon. Yeah. The
162 games. Wow.
The sort of, you know, it's a life lesson. It's showing up every day and doing the little things right. And okay. Those things build over time. And,
all right.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Life lessons.
There you go.
With baseball.
All right, John, you ready to move on?
As ready as I ever am.
All right. Today we're starting a new series on a classic book, Christianity and Liberalism by J. Gresham Machen.
Did we announce that we're reading this book?
We did not.
Okay. Because somebody texted me and said, I'm excited for this.
I don't remember announcing it.
And I remember going, I didn't realize we announced that. But I wasn't sure if it was in reference to this. In reference to something else?
I don't
or
know.
What the deal was.
Yeah, which this does remind me, we need to think about a summer read. That's coming up.
Yeah. We obviously can't do this book now, but.
No. Well, it'd be difficult to get Machen on the program.
Yes. I am not willing to have a seance on air.
All right. So this book, Christianity and Liberalism, was published in 1923. So almost 100 years ago, exactly. 101.
Nice.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about why he wrote this book, what context he is operating in to give us the ability to understand why he's writing what he's doing.
So I listened to this book a couple of times on I listened to these opening chapters a couple of times on audiobook.
Mm-hmm.
And the version I had is sort of a preface to the book and like the situation he was in. They said in there, and I don't think I knew this, that they claimed he wrote this in response to Fosdick's sermon, Shall the Fundamentalist Win?
Yeah. I think I've heard that as well.
And the timing lines up. It's within a year of that book or of that sermon coming out that he writes this book.
Yeah.
And not a huge book either. I mean, it's not massive.
No. I mean, my print copy is what? It's 180 pages-ish. Yeah.
Under 200.
So what's going on in the religious realm and in the culture? I mean, you mentioned the sermon by Fosdick, Shall the Fundamentalist Win? But what's the larger – what are the larger trends going on within the church and within culture that are at play here?
So there's a lot. I mean, we're just coming out of World War II – or excuse me, coming out of World War I.
One. Yeah.
And obviously Machen doesn't know this, but getting ready for World War II.
Yeah.
And a Great Depression that's coming. Mm-hmm. This is written in 23, so we're talking about the Roaring Twenties, a lot of optimism, a lot of boom economically. And in the religious theological world, I want to say, and please correct me if I am wrong, but the German scholarship of the time, particularly German that's sort of migrated over to the United States, sort of operates in sort of a natural – naturalism sort of way that he mentions in the opening chapter, that there is not a God that sits behind the scriptures, and that if this can't be proven, If you can't prove things in Scripture with science or naturalistic way, mm-hmm. then it needs to be thrown out. And this is causing pastors of more less confessional, maybe we could put it that way, less confessional identities, less creedal identities to come to conclusions that are not not great, throwing out Scripture, throwing out atonement, throwing out a number of things. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think I'd probably just tweak it in the sense of I think you had splits forming within the major sort of Protestant denominations. Mm-hmm. So it's not just people outside of the – today what we think of as the main lines.
Mm-hmm.
But you had people from within those denominations I think as well moving in some of those directions and you saw splits coming down the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that one of the driving impulses was the naturalism that Machen talks about. But this sense that if Christianity is going to survive.
Yes, 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 yes.
We have to change it.
Yes.
Like we have to tweak it to meet modern sensibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
Modern sensibilities, again, modern in the early 20th century sense, modern,
mm-hmm.
Are not just can't embrace supernaturalism essentially.
Yeah.
They've been so immersed in the progress of modernism, of scientific discoveries and progress in culture and in the industrial age and those sorts of things that have brought noticeable improvements in quality of life,
mm-hmm.
in medicine and in standard of life and and just like all sorts
of
areas.
Yeah.
That the thought process was, well, you can't come to people who've been taught the scientific method and talk about miracles.
Yeah.
And talk about a guy who was dead coming back to life.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that. People will just dismiss it out of hand. So how do we salvage this this thing called Christianity and make it palatable for the modern man?
And sort of their conclusion was we mine it for its values. We mine it mm-hmm. for its big picture thinking. Let's
yeah.
get away from specifics
yeah.
and specific claims and you know. Talk about God is love or
yeah.
Things like that.
Right. And I think along with that, you have this impulse. I mean, one of the sort of catchphrases that was used to capture this sort of liberal Christianity, which Machen is going to say there's no such thing really.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that, is the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of all humanity.
Hmm.
And basically like if we can just hang on to those two things – because doctrine divides.
Mm-hmm.
So we should just kind of move away from sharp doctrinal statements.
Yeah, that's the second chapter.
Yeah, yeah. And focus on morals, mm-hmm. which are good for society, and ethics, and just things that will help us all be a little nicer to one another and get along. And the sharper you are doctrinally, the less that's going to happen. So those were some of the impulses coming in. And what's striking is you had the fundamentalists, and I don't mean that in a negative sense as it's often used today.
But it's an actual camp at this time that would call yes. themselves the fundamentalists.
Yes. Essentially based on the – what's that like six volumes of essays
mm-hmm.
that were published – to defend the fundamentals of the Christian faith, which we would look back at those and go, they're basically defending inerrancy of Scripture, deity of Jesus, all those sorts
Virgin
of things.
Virgin birth was one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Things that you're like, yeah, I mean –
penal substitutionary
yeah.
atonement. Yeah.
And Machen's kind of addressing a lot of the same concerns, just doing it from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So in one sense, I think they are co-belligerents on that even though they're not working in the same circles. All right. So I think that's context.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add on the context where we dive into the
– No. I mean we're touching on the introduction quite a bit.
Yeah.
So maybe it's time to just
sure.
dive into that a little bit. Now, this is my first time reading through this. Mm-hmm. I've never read this book before. You've read it at least once, right?
Yeah.
And we should say at the outset, I hear this book, and maybe this is part of our context. I hear this book talked a lot about, and basically people going like, a lot of things in there can be applied today.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's part of our reading this as well.
Sure. Yeah. And yet at the same time, we're going to have to talk about some differences, I think.
That
help us understand how we can't just say, read Machen, here's the playbook for addressing things today. I think
right.
It's read Machen. He's got helpful insights that can apply to some aspects of our contemporary conversation.
Yeah. Well, and I think one, this has nothing about postmodernism.
Oh, yeah.
Right. That's a big one.
Sure.
That's a really, really big one.
Yeah. So in the introduction, he kind of lays out kind of why he's writing, right? So what are some things that stood out to you as he frames this conversation?
Well, I mean, I appreciate him taking time to define terms a little bit and mm-hmm. what he means. I mean, he takes a good deal of time talking about what modernism is, what liberalism is, and how they're really no religion at all. Like you said earlier, liberal Christianity isn't really a thing.
Yeah.
And he goes back to the root and saying that all of this comes from naturalism.
Yes. Yeah, that is absolutely a fundamental point. He pushes everything back to naturalism in the sense of contrasting it with supernaturalism, that
yeah.
essentially the universe is a closed system. And so on my copy, this is page 7, he says, modern liberalism can be criticized on the ground that it is unchristian and on the ground that it is unscientific. We shall concern ourselves here chiefly with the former line of criticism. We shall be interested in showing that despite the liberal use of traditional phraseology, modern liberalism not only is a different religion from Christianity but belongs in a totally different class of religions.
Hmm.
So I think that's a pretty foundational concept that he's laying out there. I also would note, as he's kind of unpacking this description of what's going on in his context, is that, he also highlights this, what he refers to as a utilitarianism.
Mm-hmm. He really gets into that in chapter 2.
That basically that people view religion as beneficial only to the extent that you can point to a tangible benefit. The issue is not, is it true? It's, is it useful? Is it helpful? Now, we would both want to say Christianity is both.
Sure.
But the first question should be, is it true?
Right, right, right.
Not is it helpful? Like it's helpful to the extent that it's true, really, is the ultimate.
Well, and I think so, I have the privilege this summer. I don't think we've mentioned this on air before. I'm going to Acton this summer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of my criticisms of Acton. I think there's a number of people there that see Christianity as really useful.
Yes.
And really even helpful.
Yeah.
But not true.
Well, did you see this? This was on Twitter within the last couple of days. Richard Dawkins.
No, I have not seen this.
He came out and basically said, I am a cultural Christian. Now, this is Richard Dawkins, Mr. Atheist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Basically saying, well, culturally speaking, I think Christianity is the most beneficial, even though I don't believe it's true.
Yeah, that's wild to me. Yeah.
He calls himself a cultural Christian now.
Interesting.
Mister, I've written how many books trying to debunk Christian claims about God?
He literally has a book called The God Delusion.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And now we're in a moment where he's like, well,
so
culturally, I guess I'd call myself a Christian because I think it's the most beneficial of the religions out there. And that's the kind – it's interesting. He says basically this is the kind of culture I would want to live in is one influenced by Christianity, even though I think it's not true. Which is fascinating.
So there is a brand of British academics that seem to be – Douglas Murray goes in the same way. I mean, Douglas Murray is a a gay man and an atheist who says, yeah, I'm a cultural Christian.
Yeah. I don't know that Jonathan Haidt would say this exactly that way, but he's not far from
it. He's not far from it.
That
yes.
Basically, I mean, given some of the things that he is interested in, I mean, his whole thing is the phone-free childhood. Like that's his big thing. And basically one of the things he talks about is people need liturgies. People need – and you're like, you're talking about Christianity. But he's like, I'm not a Christian.
But he's Jewish, yeah.
I think he's – I mean he might be ethnically Jewish.
He's ethnically Jewish,
he's agnostic, I think, or atheist in terms of his actual like beliefs.
Yes, I think that's right.
But anyway, that's a bit of a rabbit trail there. But I think what it shows is that many of the issues that pop up here are relevant can inform what we're dealing with today.
But I think for the Christians, I mean beating the drum of it's not just useful, it's actually true.
Yeah.
I think not being okay with sort of the like, well, we get to do what we want, you know, or people see us as useful, good enough.
Yeah.
No.
Because those winds can change.
Absolutely. They have.
Yeah.
It needs to be seen as true.
Yeah. And then the second chapter, which we should move into, is a whole chapter entitled Doctrine.
And it's a long chapter.
It is. But I think one of the things that comes out in Machen's discussion is that Christianity cannot be stripped of its doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
That you can't just turn it into a way of life, an ethics or a moral system divorced of truth claims.
Right.
That the two are inseparable. What are some of the ways that he kind of teases that out?
I believe it's in this chapter. He says Christianity makes historical claims, and he would say, and he I think at one point calls them scientific historical claims. Like he marries those two words together, which I hadn't seen done elsewhere, which was pretty interesting. But trying to say like, no, Jesus is a man who lived, and here are the things he did. Like these are historical truth claims and are themselves doctrine.
Yeah.
And that was really helpful. It was also helpful for him because where my mind naturally went was like, what do you do with the vast number of Protestants that disagree about a lot of stuff?
Mm-hmm.
And he addresses that toward the end of the chapter, talks about like, you know, we agree with now he, I believe, is an amillennialist and writing about premillennialists.
Mm-hmm.
Being like, we agree about a heck of a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
To paraphrase him.
You're saying he doesn't use the phrase heck of a lotta?
Heck of a lotta. it's a good bean dip. But you know, he says, we can work together. Mm-hmm. You know, there's enough overlap here that we agree about that we can work together. And I appreciate that conversation. I appreciate that.
I think one of his more helpful points as well is he really goes after the idea of you can't say you admire Jesus as a person and then completely disregard his message.
Yes.
Because his message was not just about, you know, kind of moral platitudes about, you know, the sort of the golden rule. Like obviously it's part of his teaching. But he points out Jesus taught about himself, about who he was and what he was going to do and the significance of that. And you can't just divorce that from – you know, his sort of moral teaching and say, well, you know, we can just kind of strip Jesus of those particularity claims and say, but, you know, we really like the fact that he said, you know, love your neighbor as yourself or do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Like we really like those things.
Yeah, the bumper sticker stuff. Yeah.
But he makes a compelling case that that just doesn't work. And I think, you know, I think people also – underestimate what falls under the category of doctrine. I mean, you still hear people trot out the old tired doctrine divides.
Oh, yeah.
You know, okay, well, sure. And they say that as a way of saying, well, don't talk about doctrine. Just focus on the things we can all agree on or the moral teaching that makes Christianity so distinct. Like, no. Like, those ethics have no foundation apart from the doctrinal rootedness of who Jesus is and what he's done. if you don't have that foundation, then those ethics really aren't worth much.
No. No, they're not.
So I really appreciate his emphasis on that piece of it, because you will get people who go to and say, well, oh, yeah. Because, I mean, not to turn this too political, but everybody wants to claim Jesus at some level for their political persuasions, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, 100%.
You know, so all parts of the political spectrum, like, want to say, you know, Jesus would support us. And so, you know, you start to look at some of these claims and you're like, I mean, how do you get there? Well, you divorce his moral teaching from his claims about who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And you're selective about his moral teaching that you also, you know, quote from as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What else in this chapter, John? We're kind of running out of time here.
But... Well, the hard part is there's so much in this chapter. I mean, he went into school choice at one point.
he did.
Which was just kind of wild to read about.
That this was an issue back in 1923?
Well, and my sense is – and I don't know when the public school system got going, but my sense is it was like around this time. Right? Was FDR? Is that a
– That's something I don't know.
Okay. That's outside my realm. But that's at least my sense. And he talks about like how it ruins the reading of children, and like how a goodness, I believe it was Kansas, maybe North Dakota, I can't remember, flyover state. Mentioned, you can't believe I just said that. Passed a law that said students could not learn other languages until they were in the eighth grade.
It was Nebraska.
It was Nebraska. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And he goes, yes, let's not teach children languages when they're most equipped to learn a language.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, even to hear those, oh, this is a debate 100 years ago. This is still a debate now.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. How do you think about bringing some of this doctrine conversation into the modern conversation we're having? Because there does seem to be a good bit of overlap among even, like we said earlier, churches who argue for a lack of no doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even that would call themselves evangelical churches at some level, right?
Yes, yes. I think with different ends.
Sure.
But certainly ones that would call themselves non-evangelical. Like, yeah, how are you bringing that doctrine conversation into the modern kind of conversation we're having here?
Well, I think I would go back to the distinction of, if it's not true, then you have no foundation other than just personal preference for preferring this set of morals versus another set. And so I think I would want to go back to that point and then say essentially, look, you are stripping – in one sense, you are stripping those moral values and those ethics of their actual power by disconnecting them from the gospel. That at best you'll create sort of external behaviorism and not heart transformation.
And that may last a generation, right? Right.
Some
of it may last a generation, but it's not also ultimately going to.
No. And when push comes to shove, I think that sort of external behaviorism always gets trumped by pragmatism when push comes to shove.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when push comes to shove and you have to choose between remaining true to Jesus and his morals or ethics versus, you know, persecution or suffering and that sort of thing.
Or lack of favor in the broader society. Yeah.
Then, you know, you're going to abandon that. If your whole basis for embracing it was pragmatic, then your whole basis for abandoning it's going to be pragmatic.
Yeah. And you're echoing arguments that I hear from the lips of, not going to name names, but preachers in cities in the South. You know. I again don't want to name names, but you know that like what you just said sounds very reminiscent of what I hear coming from his mouth.
Well, and I think you get part of what becomes challenging is people want to confuse or they mix They want the sort of extended kind of common grace benefits that come from Christianity without Christianity.
Yeah.
And so this is where – and I think you've heard me say this before. And this is where I always get a little nervous about conversations about human flourishing.
Mm-hmm.
Because that can be done in a way that feels disconnected from truth.
Mm-hmm.
Because that can be turned very pragmatic. Well, what's best for human flourishing here? Well,
yeah.
Well, we want to argue, of course, that the gospel is what is best for human flourishing in the holiest and truest sense of that term. But someone else might come along and say, well, no, it's repressive.
Mm-hmm.
You're not letting people be who they authentically are by saying that's wrong, this is right. You can't do that.
Yeah.
That's limiting human flourishing. And so that gets me a little nervous sometimes even as we talk about that. But that's where the pragmatism versus truth conversation comes in.
Yeah. Any final words on this? I mean it feels like we've barely scratched this chapter.
and we're already past time here. So.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, if people want to read, I know Monergism has a full PDF copy of this book.
Oh, they do.
Available
nice.
For free.
For next week, if they want to jump in, chapters 2 and 3, is that where we're going?
3 and 4, because I think we just did 1 and 2.
Oh, that's right, because I keep forgetting the introduction is
chapter one.
So it's 3 and 4.
You're 3 and 4.
So yeah, if you want to join in and get that. Again, it's funny in one sense. You hear people talk about sort of theological retrieval, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're always talking about like the church fathers.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, this is a form of theological retrieval just from 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Looking at a different context and trying to say, what does Machen have to say that can help us today?
Well, and maybe we don't want to get into too much cultural criticism, but it does feel similar. Some of the arguments Machen makes, I go, oh, I could just copy and paste that today.
Mm-hmm.
And there are others where, like, I believe the opponent has morphed and shifted and changed in ways. Is even maybe even a little bit more aggressive or
– Yeah. Well, and even the – you know, what Machen would call liberalism and its effects on the church – I think takes different forms today than it did then.
So maybe this is helpful. And let me know what you think of this. Where Machen's enemies would have looked outside themselves to naturalism, to science, to these third parties, you know, something outside themselves. Today, what's impacting the church is people saying, I will look inside myself to find some of those things.
Yeah, I think that's certainly part of it. I think also living on the other side of the sexual revolution from the 60s in particular is a big piece of that.
Mm-hmm.
That for Machen, it feels like he's dealing more with intellectual ideas. And I think the way that liberalism, as he presents it, affects the church today is more through practices, like how people live, which obviously are rooted in ideas.
Yeah.
But it tends to be rooted more in how people live rather than what they believe, at least on the surface.
Yeah.
Which I think is different from Machen's day.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think part of what liberalism was attempting to do in Machen's day is to, in one sense, maintain the morality and the ethics of the Christian tradition, but just jettison all the doctrine stuff. That's not really what you have today.
He has a great illustration in there about like, you've given up the courtyard. What makes you think they're not going to come from the citadel as well?
Yeah. Ironically, in some ways, you have the opposite of some today who want to at some level affirm the sort of foundational beliefs about the gospel at some level and then want to say, oh, but it's okay to live a sexually immoral life.
Yeah.
Like it's this weird thing where there's almost a reverse. Where liberals in Machen's day, let's keep the traditional ethics and morals. Let's abandon the doctrine. Now you've got somewhere like, let's keep most of the doctrine, but let's abandon some of the ethics and morals when it comes to the area of sexuality in particular.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's
true. But all of that is part of understanding the different context.
All right. We need to move on.
Yep.
We are We are moving
way past
moving on time.
All right, time now for this day in sports history.
All right, this day in sports history, April 2, April 2nd.
Wild.
I know my birthday's coming up.
That's right. You're an April birthday.
I am an April birthday. So are like 90% of other humans, it seems like sometimes. So I fill out birthday cards for my job. April by far is the largest month of birthday cards. 1978, Czech tennis star Martina Navratilova. I feel like that's pretty close. Wins her WTA Tour Championship, beats Yvonne Goolagong Cawley of Australia, 7-6, 6-4 at Oakland Coliseum. I noticed you didn't correct me on the second name there.
Goolagong, that's right.
Goolagong, I got that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Sometimes when you don't correct me, I don't know if I got it right or you just don't know either. And so you let me run. 1980, Montreal right wing, Guy Lafleur.
Now, actually, I do know this one. It is spelled Guy, G-U-Y, but I am pretty certain it's pronounced Guy.
Guy?
Guy
I suppose
Lafleur.
That makes sense. Lafleur. Is he French or French-Canadian?
That I don't know.
Probably French-Canadian. Scores twice to become the first player in the NHL to record six straight 50-goal seasons as the Canadiens beat the Red Wings 7-2 at Detroit. Those Canadian teams, those Montreal teams, that I don't know that we've seen a better dynasty than the Canadiens.
I just don't know enough the NHL to know anything about them.
I think they won like 8 of 10.
Okay. Well, I mean, you had the Celtics in the NBA in the 50s and 60s that had a stretch there.
Yeah, that's
and,
true.
And you had UCLA in men's college basketball.
Yeah.
But if that's the case, on those same level.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. 1984, 46th NCAA men's basketball championship, Georgetown beats Houston, 84-75. Hoyas center Patrick Ewing, tournament most outstanding player. John Thompson, the first African-American head coach to lead his team to the NCAA Division I title. Mm-hmm. There's a large part of me that would love to root for Georgetown basketball. They've just never been good.
Not really recently, no.
It's been—
I mean, once John Thompson, the first, this guy, left, they've not been good since. They've had some moments where they kind of— – they get back in the NCAA tournament, but
they had John Thompson Jr. was the coach there for a bit.
That didn't work out.
Patrick Ewing's son was on the team.
That didn't work out.
They were at least a top 25 team, I think, at that time. But they didn't have any deep runs.
No.
Patrick Ewing was the coach for a time. That didn't work out either. 1985, NCAA Rules Committee adopts a 45-second shot clock for men's basketball to begin the 1986 season in an effort to eliminate stalling.
Amen.
And they've moved on from there.
Yeah, down to 30 now. High school basketball needs a shot clock to get rid of stalling as well.
Yeah, the four corners offense, right?
Yeah.
1990, 52nd NCAA Men's Basketball Championship, Nevada— Las Vegas beats Duke 103-73 to record the largest margin of victory in a championship game. Running Rebels, first title ever.
Yeah.
First title ever. 96. Sri Lankan cricket batsman Sanath Jararusa hits century in 48 balls, 134. Off 65 in 34-run win over Pakistan in Singapore.
Singapore. It's just Singapore.
I'm sorry. I draw the line as I go, and I thought that was an H. In Singapore, world ODI record.
I'm not going to let you off the hook for Singapore. I mean,
sorry,
the fact you didn't get Sanath Jayasuriya is one thing, but—
I feel like I said that.
You did not. All right. Who do you like out of that?
Goodness gracious. Goodness, I love me some Patrick Ewing. I could go with Guy Lafleur.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Let's do it.
We're probably not going to get back to him at any point.
Don't think so. One thing you liked.
Hey, baseball is back. and the Mets are 0-3. The pain and disappointment I feel after a loss is back.
So I've wondered this because with 162 games, how up or down do you get after a win or a loss?
Too much.
Really?
Too much.
Even with 162 games?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I check the scores all the time.
Yeah, I get that. But like if the Mets lose, are you like low-key bummed?
A little bit, yeah. Okay. Yeah, a little bit.
Okay.
It lessens as the season goes on.
Depending on how they're doing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like if they're like last year they were bad.
Yes.
And so, at what point in the season were you like, yeah, I'm no longer as emotionally affected by a loss.
There is a point in the season where it turns from when you're hopeful for the team to do well to like, all right, let's develop our young players. I'm excited to see these young players take the field, and you want to see them do well.
Okay.
When they don't do well, it gets pretty rough.
There you go.
It's a dark room with a with a blanket over my head sort of moment.
All right. And your lovely wife is not a sports person.
Particularly not baseball.
Right.
She's a basketball person. She enjoys watching basketball.
Does she understand this at all?
No, she thinks it's stupid.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
She did fill out a bracket this year.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, she clearly like she's someone who if all the sports in the world disappeared, it really would not affect her life.
No. No. Now,
I mean, I know she enjoys basketball. I mean, she went to
Butler.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And was there when
That would have been when they made their Final Four runs,
I think,
right?
She was in the stadium when Gordon Hayward banked the shot and just missed it. I think she was there.
Okay.
That was her freshman year of college.
Hmm. Yeah. So, okay. I was just curious. All right. My one thing I liked is I'm going to mention another book. This is one I finished by our friend Randy Newman.
Yeah. We need to have Randy back.
We need to, yes. He wrote a book called Questioning Faith, Indirect Journeys of Belief Through Terrains of Doubt with Crossway.
Nice.
It's a really good book. It's a quick read. It's 130 pages. And he deals with different – in each chapter, he deals with different issues that can be stumbling blocks for people coming to faith. And then in every chapter, he tells at least a couple – anywhere from 2 to 5 different stories of people that he's interviewed who have come to faith through those issues or kind of working through those challenges. He does such a great job. He's done so much extensive research and talking with people about how they come to faith from all different kinds of backgrounds.
He owes us a conversation about C.S. Lewis.
He does. Should I hit him up?
I think that could be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'll reach out. We'll have our people talk to his people.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, he's an expert on Lewis.
He is. He works for the C.S. Lewis Institute, I think. Is that what the
Do we got to pay him if we ask him to? I don't want to pay him.
No. We have no money to pay him. We don't make money on this podcast. We lose money.
We lose money every year.
Yes. Yeah.
Every year.
Yeah.
We lose money.
Yeah. So that is my one thing I liked.
Have we crossed the hour mark yet?
Not yet. We're going to come under just a bit. All right, John. We have talked NCAA tournament basketball. We have talked about Christianity and liberalism. And so a reminder, don't forget if you're going to join in chapters 3 and 4 for next episode. We have talked about Guy Lafleur.
Guy Lafleur.
We have talked about baseball being back. And we have talked about Randy Newman's latest book, Questioning Faith. And so I think by definition, we have covered our various and sundry topics. And all that's left to say is, until next time. Bless you all real good.
Later.